talk about class warfare. How did the socialist communists in Albania begin to implement class warfare? Walk us through that and how it affected culture and community, you know, family.
Well, this is, I mean, everything is touchy subject, right? But if you are into the theory of all socialism and communism, you know, as they say that to have progress, you have to have a conflict. And, you know, through conflict, you always develop, you make progress. So that's why I worry when I hear Bernie Sanders saying revolution. This was a term that we heard every day, and because that calls for violence. And we were told that unless you have a violent war of the opposites, you won't have progress. So the system itself requires a sort of conflict, a sort of debate, a sort of arguing, and finalizing with a revolution, and that's how you change the system. And into our socialist communist studies, we were told that you will be able to overthrow capitalism in the United States through revolution.
This is Terry Beatley, your host of What If We've Been Wrong? I'm shining light into some dark places so that beauty, goodness, and truth defeat the schemes of the enemy. It's true, people are perishing for lack of knowledge, and we're instructed to have nothing to do with the evil deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. That's what I do on What If We've Been Wrong? Rethink, explore, and uncover some hidden truths so that more people can experience an abundant life and the joy of being set free from the shackles that hold us in prison. Welcome to What If We've Been Wrong? Hey, it's Terry Beatley, and you've tuned in, of course, to What If We've Been Wrong? And today I have a special guest, Marita McCormick. But before I introduce her, I'm going to present my idea that America has a crisis on its hand. And the crisis is this. For decades now, we have let socialists take over the government-run schools for over a century. And their philosophy, their worldview has snuck in and now totally commandeered. So if you were to ask a graduating high school student today, what is socialism? I would venture to say the vast, vast majority have no idea what socialism is. And today we're going to be interviewing Marita McCormick, who lived in Albania. She has an amazing story of suffering under the hands of socialism and really full-blown communism. You know, it's so hard to teach this like from a textbook, but if we can learn from people who have truly suffered under communism or socialism, we can help stop socialism as it is right now in America, because it's already gobbled up so many of our institutions, and it only wants more, more and more, until it has complete domination over our families, over our lives, over our economy, over literally everything. And today, we're going to provide the evidence with Marita's story. Now, the crisis in my mind is this. By the time of the next presidential election, millennials will make up 40% of the electorate. That's 40%. That's a huge number. And here's the super scary thing, is so many of them, I don't know if it was the vast majority, but it was enough of them, they actually wanted to vote for Bernie Sanders, who admitted to being a socialist. And a socialist is a kissing cousin to a communist. And if we send America down this pipeline because we sat back and allowed our children to grow up in government-run schools while we were busy working, and then we never slowed down enough to teach our children what is socialism, what is communism, and how does that completely, how is it so different from the free market enterprise system and our country, which was founded on biblical values? And so without further ado, I'd like to introduce Marita McCormick. Marita, thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thank you very, very much for having me.
Well, I think you have such an amazing story of growing up in southeastern Albania. And for those, I actually had to pull out my map because I I could put my finger on the region of where Albania was. Honestly, I did not realize it was right across the Adriatic Sea from the heel, you know, like how Italy is a boot shape. It's Albania's right across that Adriatic Sea. And of course, I know you know, I'm just letting all of our friends know who are listening, just so you know basically where in Europe we're talking about Albania. And so I'd like, Marita, for you to kind of kick off, and let's first start. I want to hear your definition of what is socialism. And we'll get into, you know, why is it so bad? What did it do to your family? But just right in from the beginning, what is socialism?
Well, funny, because I probably have still it memorized from school. So socialism is a system that advocates the state's ownership of land, industry, and capital. And communism is a branch of socialism. So communism is a political theory derived from Marx, as you know, which advocates for class war and leading to a society where all the property is publicly owned and each person is supposed to work according to his ability and to be rewarded according to his needs, which is a utopia, basically.
Which is a utopia, right? And it's never, ever, ever worked anywhere. In fact, it turns into tyranny and millions of people die. The problem, I look at it, Marita, is we have such an uneducated populace today. You know, we're talking about decades now where the socialists have taken control of our education system. And I know this for sure. My dad was very well read about socialism and communism and all that. And he gave me one of the books that they used back in 1950. And that's before, you know, the socialists had completely taken over. Socialism and communism was still being taught in the public school arena. And this little scholastic book, which was written for like 8th and 9th graders, it reads basically like a college level book today. I mean, so back in the 50s, the children were learning what is socialism, communism, and why is it so bad? And how is it so different from the American system of capitalism, free enterprise? Okay, I want to go back to this private property thing. This is huge. And I remember my father saying, watch what they try to do with property rights. And I'm actually going to read a sentence or two out of a book called The 5,000 Year Leap. It says right here that, well, I'm just going to summarize. Without property rights, lazy people can just sit back and let you and I work our tails off building and improving property. And then on a drop of a hat, the lazy people can come in and take it over. Did your family have experiences like this in Albania?
Yes. Funny that you are talking about this book. While in the 50s, this was taught here, back in Albania, we were taught the otherwise. We were taught that private property is bad, and they were quoting Engels, one of the friends of Marx, you know. But yes, to go back to your question, yes, we did during before the communism took over. Both my side of the family, paternal and maternal, owned a lot of land and a lot of other properties, like plantation of fruits and vineyards. And even to this day, in my village where I am from, which is called Tangoin, by the way, there is a hill that holds my grandfather's name, yet it doesn't belong to us because it was taken. Actually, my grandmother told me that because her husband was the only child, his parents spent all the money, and the money those days was in the form of golden coins, and they spent most of that money to buy land and forests and vineyards, because they wanted to give their son some sort of you know, cushion for him to have later in life, and some sort of, you know, assets to have. Well, communism comes and everything was taken. The first act of property taking was taking place in 1946. And then within 12 years, everybody's private property, and when I'm saying everything, when I mean everything, I'm talking not only land, not only meals, not only plants that people may own, like factories, and from the very big to the very small, to a sewing machine. Well, the sewing machine probably, there were only a couple of ladies in the village, but there was nothing that was privately owned left with the people. In our case...
Well, Marita, I'm just thinking that the average American listening to this show, it's still a foreign concept because so many people just are not read up on this, and it just seems absurd. So walk us through. Are they taking it by gunpoint? How are they literally coming over and commandeering the homes, the factories? How are they doing this?
Okay, so, well, as you know, every process of persecution has got several stages. So, first of all, they will name you. They will label you as a person that is non-desirable for the government. They gave us first, on my mother's side, they gave them the title Kulak. I don't know if the majority of your listeners are familiar with the title Kulak. K-U-L-A-K, not Gulag. Gulag is a place. I'm talking Kulak. So they would name you as a person that you are not in line with the communist government's program. So you are labeled as an anti-communist.
Well, you know what this is reminding me of? I mean, like profoundly. Mm-hmm. When you just said one of those words, mm-hmm. it reminds me when Hillary Clinton called, you know, conservatives, deplorables.
Mm-hmm. Deplorables.
She had the audacity to label us as deplorables.
I'm not born in the United States, but when that word came, I felt like I was being reminded the same thing, like bullying, being bullied, over here, because I relate to that. My parents were called that in different words, of course, because deplorable in English sounds different than what it sounds in Alabama, but it's in the same category. So they were given the name, they were called names, they were marginalized. For example, when my grandfather from my mother's side was titled a kulak, that meant that you were the enemy of the party, you had no rights to vote, you had no rights to assembly, you had no, basically no rights to participate in any part of that village life. You were left on your own. And the property taken was the last thing. So what they did, my mother has vivid memory about this, and when I tell this story, I think of my mom, and I get a little bit of teary-eyed because she keeps repeating it. The government representatives in the village, they went and they just took them out and they said, you don't belong. And they took the men and they put the men into some forced labor camps in the northern Albania. And then they took the women and children and then they put them in another house in the village where they joined by a couple of other families from the village that were named with the same title. And my mom's house and all the property that they owned around, they had barns and they had lots of trees, tree plantations and all of that. It was a large estate. All of this was taken and it was given to the government to work for the whole village, serving the whole village. Basically, my mom's, one of the houses was turned into a blacksmith and part of their estate was turned into barns. For the village storage rooms, and everything else was converted to basically what the government wanted to use it. While on my father's side, we had very big house, and I remember I lived with the people. They used the upper level of our house as rooms to board the teachers that came from the city. And then they gave free accommodation to the teachers using our house. They said we need to educate the children, and we have to use some place. And you have more than enough. And they forced that upon us.
Now, how old were you when this happened?
Well, I grew up with this. I was born into a house that already was hosting teachers.
Oh,
I thought that they were members of our family.
Oh, gosh.
Because they were living with us, and they were, you know, my grandmother was very generous, and she would, you know, there were a couple of young ladies that were teachers in the village, and my grandmother would bring them food. And I remember one of them was pregnant. She was married, but her husband was in the city. And my grandmother was tending to her because, you know, she was a human being. This girl did nothing, you know, wrong personally, but she was given this by the government. So
Wow.
even she refused it, you know. So yes, so we basically, all this was taken. Yes, at some point it will have been at you know, at gunpoint if people refused to. A lot of my friends would tell that when they were taken for the forced labor camps, they usually would happen after midnight, between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning. And
Wow.
actually, I was talking today. I don't know if you have a minute. I wanted to share a story about a family which was taken like that and was left for 2 weeks on the street.
Yeah, and I
This
definitely
was.
want to cover, you know, like military, the compulsory military, but first tell us about what happened with that family.
Oh, no, I was, okay. So this family was taken at the gunpoint. What they would do, they would put them in these forced labor camps. And whenever they wanted, for whatever reason, there were whatever reason, let's say that a leader of another communist country was coming to visit, and then they will go and commit this ransacking, that they commit this acts of violence towards these poor people that were just put there because they were anti-communist, and then they will just grab them in the middle of the night and just put them in a truck and just drop them in another village. And he said that they dropped my family in the middle of another village, and we had nothing to eat, we had nothing to nowhere to sleep, and we would go and beg for food to the other villagers.
Wow.
And he said people thought that we were traveling people, you know, the Roma, the traveling people. But he said they came and they looked at us and they said, oh, they have got blue eyes, who are they? And he said they were looked at, you know, in a very strange doubt, like, who are these people? They couldn't figure it out. And he said we were starving, and one of the cousins actually noticed that there was a man that was letting a dog out in the morning and in the evening, and he started to follow him because he said he was feeding the dog outside. And he said one night he just saw him put the food outside. And then the owner went in, and he said he went and he grabbed the dog's food because he was starving, and the food was basically made bran and water. And he said he was very happy going on the street eating. So, I mean, things like this were common.
All right, we'll be right
Sure.
back. Our listeners, don't go anywhere. It's going to be an hour that you don't want to miss.
Let the silent voices be heard. It's the rallying call that started it all. AmericaOutloud.com. For a wide spectrum of programming from world and political news, societal and cultural stories, law enforcement, our military heroes, and much more. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
You're back on What If We've Been Wrong? This is Terry Beatley, And today I'm interviewing Marita McCormick. She grew up in socialist, communist Albania. And boy, does she have a story to talk about. So we talked about what happens with the loss of personal property rights in the first half. And I want to draw attention to something before we swing over to the topic of class warfare, because we know ultimately that's how they try to divide and conquer. But this, and I remember my father, Marita, who was very well read about communism, socialism, he always talked about watch what they do with personal property rights, because if the government can ultimately take away your personal property rights, so then the government, quote, owns all the property. What's the first thing it does is it destroys the incentive to be industrious. Because why would my husband go out there right now as a self-employed man with a good thriving business, and he's working really hard and he's providing for our family, and what incentive would he have if everything we did with our money, whether we bought cars or built houses or invested in new businesses and we could employ other people, what incentive would he have if he knew the government could take it all away?
Yes.
Food for thought. And if you have any comments on that, go ahead, and then we'll swing on over to class warfare.
Well, I mean, there is my dad is very humorous, and he always used to tell us stories and used to make it a little bit easier. We'll use sarcasm and irony, describing exactly what you just talked about, us not being industrious, because there was no reason. And for the government, of course, the reason was very clear, because you want to keep the less industrious people are, the easier it is to keep them suppressed, but for the people, once you have no interest into certain something, then you don't flourish. So if you meet a lot of people from my country that are at my generation, we may be full of ideas and we may have these great ideas, but it's very difficult for us to take that first step and just break into, because we were suppressed and
exactly.
We were kept.
Right.
And that's unfortunately the case, but that's not the case with my children. And that's why I'm grateful they're here, but also that's why I'm worried that they might have a precedent like we just had to bring the country to similar level of to where I escaped from. So that's why I've decided to tell the story as well. And I thank you for inviting me to the show.
Absolutely, yes. And Marita's book, she'll soon be publishing it, and it's called Life Under Communism. Do I have that right? Life Under Communism?
Life Under Communism in Albania.
In Albania. Life Under Communism in Albania. So again, Marita McCormick is the author. And so Marita, let's talk about class warfare. How did the socialist communists in Albania begin to implement class warfare? Walk us through that and how it affected culture and community, family.
Well, this is, everything is touchy subject, right? But if you are into the theory of socialism and communism, as they say that to have progress, you have to have a conflict. And, through conflict, you always develop, you make progress. So that's why I worry when I hear Bernie Sanders saying revolution. This was a term that we heard every day, and because that calls for violence. And we were told that unless you have a violent war of the opposites, you won't have progress. So the system itself requires a sort of conflict, a sort of debate, a sort of arguing and finalizing with a revolution, and that's how you change the system. And into our socialist communist studies, we were told that you will be able to overthrow capitalism in the United States through revolution.
Right.
So keep that in mind. So in Albania, to implement that, you need some sort of conflict, right? And who are you going to fight? You have to fight each other. So by definition, the class warfare is like a political and military conflict between economic classes. The idea is typically identified with Marx, who characterized revolutions as conflicts between economic classes when a new growing class comes into conflict with an established upper class. So in my family, in both sides of the family, let's say, we were considered what you call a middle upper middle class, because they owned property and they had a lot of means of production and they had enough, you know, wealth to be classified as such. So we were the ones that were to be overthrown. So we were on the side of being fought at. So families were divided, even though we were the family, the part of the society that were fought at, even within our side, let's say, anti-communist class, you still had several strata. You had those who were called kulaks. You had those who were called reactionaries or enemies of the class. You were those who were arrested. You were those who were put in those gulags in the forced labor camp. So basically, families were divided, brother with brother and brother with sister. Our dictator killed his own brother-in-law.
Did he really? So, and who was the dictator? Who was the first one?
The dictator's name was Enver Hoxha.
Okay.
Enver Hoxha. He ruled from 1944. Well, he and his close friends from 1944, and he died in the mid 80s. And then after that, it was his Ramiz Aliyev, which was his follower. But basically, to go back to the class warfare, it was called it was like the vital part of the socialism development. It was seen as the main thing, as the main instrument to develop the country. Mm-hmm. So it had to be done. And so to give you a little example, so my grandfather was a kulak, and by given that title, it meant that up to three generations, we were not allowed to go to any school of our choice. We were not allowed to participate into, you know, whatever life the village had. We were not allowed to move. We were not allowed to get any employment by the state. But we were only permitted to live where we were born. The only way we could move, it was by marriage. So basically, we were imprisoned in our own villages, and we were not allowed to do anything else, let alone being industrious and starting businesses and what the Americans are doing. And the Americans, I'm sorry to say, including my children, have no idea.
No, Americans have no idea. And my father passed away a number of years ago. That when Barack Obama, my father did not believe that Barack Obama could win that first election. He didn't. Here he was so well read about communism, socialism. He didn't believe that our country, that enough people could not see through the lies of what Barack Obama was saying, doing, and the political party platform. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it perfectly lays out socialism, mm-hmm. and I remember mm-hmm. holding up signs. I guess that was the election with,
Sarah Palin.
Thank you, Sarah Palin, yeah. And holding up a sign saying, you know, stop socialism. Mm-hmm. There was a crowd of like 350 people. As far as I could tell, my sign was the only sign calling it out for what it was. If we don't stop it, we're going to turn into a socialist country. And so, yes. And now, you know, all those years later, there's Bernie Sanders unapologetically mm-hmm. being, you know, identifying himself as a socialist. And so, yeah. And the Democrat Party is as well. They're just not letting everybody know. Okay, so
yes.
So we have to wake up, because 40% of the electorate, the next presidential election, are going to be millennials. And millennials mm-hmm. have not learned what is socialism. They just think, oh, well, it sounds good because they get free this and free mm-hmm. that and free that. Well, tell our listeners how free was free. I mean, your free was shackles.
No. It was, no, there is no, there is no free. It's in quotes, you know. It's, you put it on quotes, and it's just the word free, because there is nothing free. I'll tell you what, and maybe we're jumping a little bit on the subject, but, and I talk a lot about these things, and actually I talked about this today at some conversation.
Mm-hmm.
we were in the village. We were in the most rural area, and we were what they were called agriculture cooperatives, where we produce the food, like the grain and all the things to feed the rest of the population, to feed the city, right? So we had an obligation. The government had put a certain obligation upon us to produce and to give that to the government, whatever the need was for the population in the city. And guess what? If we didn't have enough, they will take even what it was left for us to be fed during the months of winter. And then we would be left with nothing. Wow. And when I see cornbread, I feel very nervous, because I remember we at times will be for 6 months eating just cornbread in the evenings.
Because how old were you during this whole time period?
Oh, all my life. I mean, I left Albania in 1994.
Okay.
So I only lived for 3 years when they started to decentralize and to privatize. So those 3 years, I gave some contribution to that. I worked with a foreign government-sponsored project. It was an Italian, I believe, an Albanian project, and I helped with that as a project administrator. But up to that, 3 years prior to leaving Albania, so I was born in 1966, so I'm not shy to tell my age. So, I was, you know, all life until 25. I lived through like that.
Wow! So when you see cornbread, it gives you the chills.
Chills. And then somebody has to remind me, this is American cornbread and it's warm. It's fine.
Right.
you can swallow it.
Well, you know, but when you think about when private property gets stolen, gets taken away by the government. And then it disincentivizes the industrious people, because I mean, why would they work really hard? And then that land gets shifted over and given away to other people, whoever the government wants to own it. But then those people really aren't secure either, because the government could take them out, put somebody else in.
So the thing is that the government took it. You still dug the field. You still use the tractors. You still use, but it was everything organized by the government, directed by the government. All the production went to the government, and the government distributed it to the people.
Mm-hmm.
And we had people that were in charge, but we were so organized to the smallest unit, and the smallest unit would have been 10 people, and will be this unit. We were called them teams, and you will have 7 to 8 teams in one brigade. It was like a military formation, and this formation was reflected on all aspects of life, whether it was economic aspects, whether it was work aspects, whether it was education, whether it was military. It was everything in a formation and a uniformity. It was exactly the same. We were individual teams, brigades. And then that we went and we worked and dug the fields and did everything. But the government managed it. And when you leave it up to the government has no interest but, to do the bare minimum.
Right, the bare minimum. Right, exactly. Working for excellence, competition. There is no competition when the government owns it. You know, I come from a small community, and I remember for the longest time we only had one grocery store there. You know, nice grocery store, great, you know, it's like three different families owned it. But let's face it, they did nothing to improve that grocery store. Well, then, I don't know, Food Lion came into town. And boy, they started polishing up those floors better. And they just made, you know, the mom and pop store, they really cleaned up their act a lot better. And then Winn-Dixie came to town. The mom and pop shop did a complete facelift on the store, and the competition helped. The competition made the other ones try to be the best that they could be. But when government owns it and manages it, they don't give a rat's you know what how well it runs.
Yeah. Well, that's true, because you have a free market-driven economy, which is based on free competition. And then you have the centralized economy, which is the communist, socialist, economy, where government does, government is supposed to do everything, but we know government cannot do everything,
right,
because that's not the role. It's outside of its nature.
Exactly.
Why it doesn't work. That's why it didn't work. And I am not shy, and I'm a little embarrassed because I feel sorry for my compatriots who might be listening to this. But I'll tell you, I was a teenager and I was at the brink of starvation. And I remember my mother crying, saying that my daughter is developing and she has to be prepared for motherhood for later in life.
Mm-hmm.
A teenage girl, you know, and we didn't have enough to eat. I have written a story which is called White Water for Breakfast. We used to get a liter of milk from the government, and we lived in a village. You would think we would have animals, right? But mm-hmm. the motto of the government was to make the village like the city, to make it all uniform everywhere. And my grandfather was sick, so we were given a liter of milk per day mm-hmm. to feed the sick person. So I would go and buy the milk in the morning before I went to school. Or I would buy it in the evening. It depends on when the milk was available. And in the morning, we'll see this liter of milk multiplied. And I'll say, Granny, what happened? Where did you get the extra milk? Until one day I spotted she was putting 2 liters of water in it to make it look more, so the whole family could eat. And then we would eat that with some bread, and then we'll go for the day. Okay, I went to school, but what about my dad and my mom who went to work?
Mm. These stories
need
to be told. They so need to be told because, I mean, we live in the land of plenty, but it can be taken away. If Hillary Clinton had won, our country would have slid right down into the muck and mire of full-blown socialism. And it's bad enough mm-hmm. now. I mean, think about it, Marita. I mean, it was under Barack Obama. They not only took over health care. So, I mean, I don't want anybody listening thinking, oh, well, America is like completely full-blown, full enterprise. No, it's not. You know, the government's all over so many different brackets of our economy. But it was under Barack Obama that he was trying to force Little Sisters of the Poor to offer, you know, contraception. You know, that's government mandated central control, completely violating the conscience of the nuns.
Right.
Oh yeah. All right. So we've got just a few seconds left. Any other thoughts you want to share just to wrap up about class warfare? How did you see it, like maybe in the schoolroom? Did you experience class warfare there?
Yes. Because every child had heard at home, this family, for example, is the enemy of the class. They would actually paint on our walls. Like we were, in Albania, it's old country and you have houses and yards surrounded by walls. And we were supposed to paint them white. So we had to look clean, right?
Mm-hmm.
So on our walls outside, they would write slogans. Like, for example, long live the Communist Party of Albania, or long live the Central Committee of Albania. So most of the obvious places where this was written were selectively chosen. So we, the enemies, would read them and we'll be reminded of how powerful the party is and how nothing we are, right?
Right.
So my classmates knew who I was, that my grandfather was a kulak and that I had no future. So there was this guy, you know, God bless him because I pray for him and I've forgiven him, but he was reminding me every morning that I was no one and that I belong nowhere.
And hold that thought right there, Marita. We're going to cut for a break. And then when we come back, we're going to hear the rest of Marita's story of what it was like to be a kid in the classroom, having to endure socialism, full-blown communism, and why we must put a stop to it in the United States of America. All right, we'll be right back.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends, with 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Thanks for coming back to What If We've Been Wrong. I'm interviewing Marita McCormick, who grew up in communist socialist Albania. And we were just talking about, before the break, what it was like in the classroom. Here she was, a starving high school student, and her family was completely ostracized. They had had all their private property stolen from them, and she's basically living in a government, you know, group home. And Marita, you were telling us about a guy in your class. Finish telling your story about him.
Yes, but let me correct a little bit there. The family, the government group home was for my mother, and I lived in my home, but our home was taken by the government to be used as boarding for the teachers.
So, got it.
Mm-hmm. But that's okay. Well, I mean, we were friends, and I don't want to make, you know, my friends, you know, like the children interact and all of that, but everybody knew who was the other. And for those of us who were from those anti-communist families that were known, there was always this going on, and I didn't know that it was bad. I said, okay, this guy has something to say, he can say something. It didn't feel right. I would go and complain to my father or to my mother, and I remember very well. Actually, there is another story that I've written. It's called the Lilac Flowers is the title of the book, but the story is called Mira's Lilac. Mira is the name, where students usually would go and pay homage to the, you know, to the martyrs of the village that have fought, or so we thought they fought during the World War II. But actually, this was only the communists who had fallen. They didn't include the rest of the people that were killed. Another story.
Right.
So
mm-hmm.
They had to go and pay homages and bring flowers and do the guard of honor at the monument in the village. And they never chose me or my brothers. And I always was questioning and answering. And my dad would say, well, he said to me, just so you know, they will never put you a guard there because they think you don't belong. And he said, and that's fine. But aren't you proud that your lilac is there? Because we had this lilac that bloomed first in the whole village, and everybody would come to get lilacs at our house. So they tried to balance how I felt about it and how to deal with it. They didn't want to plant hate in my soul, but they also told me a little bit, like, this is how it is, you know, we have to endure this. Maybe it's not going to be for life, but do your best at what you can do, because, you know, time and again we were refused certain schooling. You probably know that when I was 13, they didn't allow me to go to a special school because they said your family is not entitled to it. You have to be a communist family to attend certain schools. So I kind of grew up with it, and I thought, well, this is how it is, because I had nothing to compare with.
Exactly.
So it was the same. I mean, for me, it was like this and other things. But there were, for other people, it was much worse, because their dads were put in jail, or, you know, their grandfathers were executed. So, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, we had, everybody had their own cross to bear, so
right.
to say.
Okay, what about the religious life in Albania? Because I know there, well, what was your experience and the impact that socialism had on it?
Well, I don't know if your listeners know, but in 1967, Albanian government proclaimed Albania as a country, as an atheist country by constitution. That meant that religion was considered a crime. So if you practiced religion, you were a criminal, and then you would go to jail. So what they did, and this, Terry, and this took only a decade. Within a decade, it started with stereotyping the clergy, especially the Catholic clergy. Remember that, the old clergy, because Albania, as you know, has Muslims and Catholic Christians and Orthodox Christians.
Right.
So, and Albanians have been living together because we have had other issues with sustaining as a country. So it hasn't been much of a problem. But Catholic clergy, in particular, was really targeted, and in the thousands they were executed by gunfire.
Right.
And then in 1967, by 1967, when the country was declared atheist, all the institutions, all the objects of worship, like churches and convents and monasteries, everything was either destroyed or closed. And how do you feel, Terry? Think of the most beautiful cathedral that you know.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the most beautiful cathedral, and the government closes it.
Yeah,
and change it into a entertaining center.
Church growing over there? I mean, I would think it's growing leaps and bounds.
It is.
Okay.
Yes,
but
it is.
Is it government controlled or is it a free now?
No, it's a free. No, right now, no.
Okay.
It's good. And actually, the nuncio there is an American archbishop.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not up on it. So okay.
The church is in good hands, and you have a lot of Protestant church. The Protestant church as well is there. So Christianity is mm-hmm. Is there, and so I don't think we have many Jewish people there because there used to be a group, and there is a nice story about that. But I think there is Muslims and Christians, and the Christians are Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestants. And
okay.
Albania had never had Protestants, so.
Interesting.
There's a lot of
Now, what about the arts and culture? How was that affected that you could tell by growing up and then as
sure.
a
this is,
woman?
Sure. So into a socio-communist society, you have to have a ideological, as to say, invisible thread that touches every aspect of life. So you have to have communism and communistic ideas into communist ideology, into politics, into economy, into education, military, and of course arts and culture. So everything has to be painted with this ink, as to say, which we call red, right? Communist.
mm-hmm.
And arts and culture were no exception. So you had to develop only one, so to say, way of artistic value, which was called socialist realism.
Wait, let me say that. So, socialist realism.
Realism.
Right. Okay.
So socialist realism. You could not have, let's say, you could not have rock music. You could not have impressionist paintings. You could not use certain metaphors into poetry. And as a matter of fact, there were two poets that were executed, they were killed because they used symbolism in their poetry.
You're kidding me. The government killed two poets because they used symbolism.
They made the case for them, yes. They prohibited a certain lyric poet which is from a nearby town. His name was Lazgush Poradeti. He wrote this most beautiful lyrics. He was prohibited. It was not published because, again, we come to the private property, right? No competition. Publishing was controlled by the government. Only government can publish. The writers were on salary. The writers were appointed by the government as a writer. It was a profession. And you would go and travel, and you would get paid by the government, and then you would write certain number of books per whatever period, and you will get salaried. I mean, if you had a talent like you do have and write a book, well, so bad. You are not on the government payroll. You are not published. So the government controlled who to publish, what to publish. Actually, There were certain people who controlled what it was published out abroad, and then they will screen what to be allowed into the country, and then they will let only a certain. So, believe it or not, the last American writer in my time that we knew was Jack London.
Really?
Everybody else, after that, we have no idea. We didn't know anything about arts and culture abroad, overseas, except what it was let in. And that's, I will volunteer some information here, but that's how I learned English, because my father said to myself and my brothers, you will never learn the truth and beautiful things if you don't learn another language, because in Albanian they are giving you very little. We used to be given targets, and on the last day of the military training, we would have live shooting. We would be given 3 bullets to shoot from 100 meters distance. And guess who was on the target? Can you guess?
Oh, who was in the target?
Yes.
My guess would be an American.
Yes. It would be an American president.
Really? How about that?
Yes.
Wow, the arch enemy,
yes.
an American president,
yes,
who would be standing
right
up for free enterprise, capitalism, individualism, liberty, and justice for all. Wow.
Yeah. It hurts, because I, at home, I was said so nice things about United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a couple of times I just shoot outside of the target. I didn't want to. And I was severely scolded for that.
Wow, golly. Well, look, we only have a couple minutes left. Let's swing your story, your experiences back to the United States. You know as well as I know what's happening in our country, in our culture, you know, in politics and all this. The socialists, the communists are here. I remember my father describing to me the man who was the first card-carrying communist in the United States Congress. And we know it's here. We know our children are learning socialism, and they're learning one world government. They're not learning patriotism. So what would be your, if you could change a few things, what would you change, Marita?
Elect presidents that are declared that are not communists. Don't elect Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. Now, I'm not saying that they are not the whole Democrats are socialists, but please don't fall for the lies of propaganda that we hear here and now, and don't fall for the what they are selling it as, you know, empathy for the other, and helping each other, because the real flourishing of a system, and the best system that is proven so far, is a free market economy. And I grew up, I saw how it was to be a centralized economy. So the closer you move to a centralized economy, the closer you move to slavery, actually. You become dependent on government. And you don't want people to become dependent on government, because it doesn't work like that. We tried it, and I told you that we suffered a lot.
Well, it's a breaking system. I mean, if you have half of the country, mm-hmm, which that's where we're at right, mm-hmm, now, relying on government,
right,
you know, how much,
right,
can you squeeze out of the working,
right,
people in the form of,
right,
taxes?
And elect representatives that understand this. So what makes an educated representative? Well, it starts in school. So make sure, you know, check what the children are taught at school. If your child goes to public school, raise your voice, express a concern, and talk to your child. If the child is mistaught at school, teach him or her at home. And then rely on programs and materials like, you know, the book that you have written on life issues. And for example, I would recommend that it's Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation in Washington, D.C. They have developed a book that is a supplemental to the high school curriculum that talks about the evils of communism. So
excellent.
Do your research. Mm-hmm. Be on guard. I tell my children, although my children now are in their, 18 and 20 and 22, I think I've made their brain, hurt from telling them how things work and how they don't work.
Right.
So educate yourself and educate your children and elect the representatives that really, really understand the issue. And I think, you know, freedom is key. When people understand what real freedom is, and I think there is a priest who talked about this, freedom for and freedom for. So make sure you know freedom from what and freedom for what.
Exactly.
And individual freedom is very important because if your freedom is gone, then everything else goes within, you know, a very, very short time. So educate, be on guard, make your voice be heard.
Marita, I want to thank you for being on the show today. We are out of time, and I have a feeling I could easily interview you, probably go a little bit deeper into all these topics, maybe on another recording here. And thank you so much, Marita. Well, I'm going to have you back.
Thank you.
All right, America, what if we've been wrong in not being educated about socialism and communism? And those rascals are getting away. They're creeping, that long encroaching arm of big government. So what if we've been wrong? Hey, we are Shining Light in Dark Places with Marita McCormick. And we'll see you next week.